The House Hess Committee to order. It is about 8 minutes after 3. And let the record show that the following members are present: Representative Cisna, Representative Keller, Representative Gardner, Representative Roses, and myself, Wilson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. And I'd like to recognize my House Recording Secretary is Kelly Burnett. Our LIO monitor is Sammy. And our committee aide is Becky Rooney. So before we start, I'm just reminding you in this room that the cell phones, even on vibrate, interfere with some of our stuff here, so please turn your cell phones off. And everything got switched around today, I don't know how many times, but our first bill that I was going to have, those people are up in finance right now, so we are going to go ahead and do House Bill 420, Anatomical Gifts. And so what I will do is have my aide. She is going to go over the bill, give us a little bit about what the bill is about, and then do a sectional. And then we have people online that are experts on this. And so let me see. We have a Mr. Bruce Zellneritis and Deborah Baer, who is with Legal, and she's also the Commissioner of Uniform State Laws. And so most of this is a housekeeping bill, kind of to put our statutes in line with the federal statutes. And so, so that's a lot of gobbledygook as far as making this statute and that statute, and also Dr. Butler. So, with having said all that, Becky, I'll let you go ahead and present it to us.
For the record, my name is Becky Rooney. I work for Representative Peggy Wilson. And you have a lengthy bill before you, HB 420. And although it's 24 pages in length, it is basically a cleanup bill. And it updates Alaska statutes regarding organ donation. There is a piece of model legislation called the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act that serves to harmonize organ and tissue donation laws in all 50 states and the federal government. The UAGA has been doing this for over 40 years. Alaskan statutes regarding organ donation are already based on the UAGA, but they are modeled after the last significant update, which was in 1987. HB 420 brings Alaskan statutes in line with the most recent version, the 2008 revised UAGA. The Department of Law, the Department of Health and Social Services, the State Medical Examiner's Office, Life Alaska Donor Services, and representatives of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws were involved in the development of the bill language to ensure a sound piece of legislation, and so far everyone has been pretty happy with the results. Madam Chair, it is very important to note that an estimated 180 Alaskans are in need of life-saving transplants and waiting for a donated organ to become available. Hundreds more are waiting for tissue transplants. Because the bill is basically a realignment of statutes with the 2008 Uniform Anatomical Gift Act language, I won't go through the sectional unless you or through the bill itself, and you have a sectional in front of you. So if you want to ask questions from that, because it's pretty much just changing conforming language. And if you have questions, we really have a great panel of experts here to answer those questions that can talk to each one of the questions you have. So I thank you for the opportunity to speak on 420, and I hope that we can pass it out of committee.
Are you going to go? You're not going to go through the section?
You know, I started to, and it's just making, almost most of it is making conforming language, and so I thought maybe if you wanted to kind of thumb through it and ask questions, we have the experts here that that can answer those questions.
Okay. Actually, this is the first time I've had a sectional that was 6 pages long.
I know.
But anyway, let's just take a little bit, a brief at ease, and let the committee look through this. So we're going to take a brief of these. Representative Roses, you had a question?
I did. On section, I think it's in section 15. It's page 6, anyway. Starting at line 18 on the refusal to make an anatomical gift and the effect of the refusal. Could you go a little bit into what that section does? Because what I don't want to have is family members battling over who can and can't decide once somebody is not able to make the decision for themselves. And I think that's what this section addresses. So if you could hit the highlights for me, that might save us some time instead of me asking 5 or 6 questions.
This is Deborah Baer, and I'm an Alaska Uniform Law Commissioner. I'm also employed by the Alaska Department of Law, and you have hit on the key section for a person who wishes to express his or her wish, that she does not want to donate a gift. A donation of an anatomical gift is a totally voluntary act. In the prior act, there wasn't a clear way for somebody to come and say, look, my religious views are such that I do not want to give a gift. I want everybody to know that. That's what this refusal provision is for. So you can set out in a document, I have no interest in giving an anatomical gift. So later on, if something happens, you get an auto accident, the family isn't fighting about what was mom or dad's wishes, what was the child's wish, that sort of thing. It's clear in the document. It's clear the statute recognizes refusals. And it's a really strong provision for people who have views that they do not wish to give anatomical gifts.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
I was under the impression that in the state of Alaska, the anatomical gifts would not be given unless the person is so indicated, and it's indicated on your card. We are not creating a situation where the only way it doesn't happen is if you opt out. I mean, that becomes the default position. That doesn't do that, I assume.
No. And I appreciate this again, Deborah Baer, Department of Law. What the Anatomical Gift Act does is set up a procedure, first of all. Most organ donations in the state of Alaska, frankly, are done on the driver's licenses. It gives you a good time to think about what do you want to do in case that there is an untimely death. You can check the box, and that expresses your wish to give an anatomical gift. There are some people, due to their lifestyles or whatever, they don't drive. They have nothing, and they pass away, and then the family is in a difficult situation at the time of the, and it's usually something serious like an auto accident or something like that. What would this person have done if they were asked? And so they have a list in the statutes in this bill as to how you deal with that situation where someone has not expressed a wish on the driver's license. So the family members can be consulted. Also takes into account, I know this committee has spent a lot of time with the health wishes bills, how you can express it there, so the doctor can look at that as well and come up with a decision that makes best for the family as a whole. Yes, so yes, you don't, it addresses much more than refusal.
So you want to go into it, because I read it earlier. I think it doesn't have to have two people that make the comments or that have to.
Well, there's a couple, excuse me, through the chair. If you, when you're making a gift while you're still alive, you can go to the driver's license and check it, and that's your firm wish of what you want. If you decide that you have nothing and you're in a hospital dying, and the nurse and the doctor are there saying, and you wish to at that point say, I would like to give anatomical gifts, that's where you have the two persons, one of which must be disinterested and all that. But if you have a document with your driver's license, the doctor is got the evidence there that he can go forward, he or she can go forward.
Representative Gardner has a question.
Yes, thank you. I'll have to confess I haven't read every provision of this or the other. And I guess what I'm really interested in knowing is if this bill passes as presented, in what ways will Alaska statute, if any, differ from the Uniform Anatomical Gifts Act?
And through the chair, that's an excellent question. When you do uniform acts, there are some conforming provisions that deal with your specific statutes in the state, such as we can define state as Alaska, things like this. This is drafted very tightly against the Uniform Act. We have made some minor changes to deal with the medical examiner's office, because our medical examiner's office here is very unique how it's structured. If you watch television, the medical examiner runs to the scene and checks the body and releases it at that point. Well, we don't have that luxury in the state of Alaska because we have a limited medical examiner. Where we have our accidents and are anywhere in the state. And so oftentimes you're dealing with telecommunications, people are saying, bring the body into the medical examiner to check for. So we had to do amendments to deal with that situation. And the Uniform Law Commissioners were very comfortable with that change. Do you have anything else you want to add, Dr. Butler?
Thank you. So in all other respects, in terms of who authorizes when, how, who denies, all of that, we're in conformity.
Absolutely, and that's a very, I would like to use that as an overture to tell you that's a really important point with you with the anatomical gift, because when a crisis situation occurs, you don't want to have a disagreement as to what the law is in a particular state. The doctors and the EMS people need to know what it is at that point in time, and oftentimes in anatomical gifts, you have the accident occurring in one state, the donor person in another state, the family members in three or four states, so it's really great if all the state's law matches.
Actually, maybe I will make a comment.
Dr. Butler.
Through the chair. What the bill does in terms of working with the state medical examiner's office is not so, it really isn't a change in procedure. It just more institutionalizes what the practice has always been. Our state medical examiner has had a good ongoing relationship with the donor agencies. This just makes it a little more formalized.
Thank you, and just, Madam Chair, thank you. Just for the record, I'm more interested in material differences that aren't specific but that have to do with an individual's relationship with the law and their choices and family involvement and all those kind of things. And frankly, Madam Chair, if we're in conformity with the uniform rule, I'm happy with it.
Representative Sisley, you had a question?
I did. I'm fairly sure I was on this committee a number of years ago. It seems like a number of years ago when we actually heard this bill. And I think it's maybe more than once that there was some conforming language. And what I'm wondering is if, in fact, you have a sense of that. And I'm looking through this. It's kind of hard to tell. It's exactly what I mean, we can see the things that actually are real changes, but where maybe the sense of the changes are. And you did say that it was maybe kind of tightening up maybe some things that maybe through court cases or that kind of thing came out as problems, and so tightening it a little bit for that. Is that the general nature of the confirmation that is going on here, and in what way? I guess my question would be, since this state tends to love to have sort of individual freedom as much as possible, in what way does that kind of strengthen that or that kind of thing? If you wouldn't mind answering that question.
I'd be glad to. Again, Deborah Baer, and through the chair. The advantages of the Uniform Act is basically, I think it strengthens individual decision making because you can clearly state what your wishes are about giving an anatomical gift. The doctor is put in a great situation of knowing what your wishes are in advance, which is always the best thing. And if you don't have your wishes expressed, then there's a procedure in this act to say exactly how things are going to be handled. What I found interesting was it may be your children making the decision, but what if you have four children or three children and two want to go one way and one wants to go another way on anatomical gifts? The statute, the bill as written, says the majority of your children will. So the single child would not have a veto power over the gift. And that's clear now. Before, it was more of a consensus building. Doctors would have to get family into some sort of an agreement that they would feel was best for the family.
Yeah.
And so that is recognizing people's and family rights very particularly. The ability to give you a refusal, clearly, so if your religious views are such you don't want to go there, it's absolutely clear in the statute that that's fine. Also, the statute recognizes donor registries, which are a new thing from when the prior bill was adopted and recognizes clearly in statute state issued ID cards, which is a lot of older people who do not choose to drive anymore. The ID card would be a way for them to do it. It allows, it gives this a working relationship with the medical examiner that we've talked about before. And it talks about electronic thing, electronic transmissions and electronic agreements, such that if you have a family member in overseas in the military duty, how could he or she give their wishes? This bill will recognize electronic expression of wishes and on how they'd like a family member's gift handled. It's been endorsed by many medicals and associations. This is a movement all over the United States. Over 20 states already have it, and there's at least 15 states right now it's pending.
Thank you.
Representative Keller?
No.
You have a question?
No, thanks.
Representative Gardner.
Okay. Suppose my mother had a state ID card and she wanted to be a donor, and I knew about that card, but when she died, I couldn't find the card. Is there access then to the donor registry or the DMV records or whatever it takes to verify that?
Both of those are possibilities. The registry is the one that is a very good way so that people can express their wishes, get on the registry, and then in an emergency situation, people can, the emergency technician, people can check.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Roses.
Thank you. I wanted to go to page 14 of the bill, if I could, line 10. We've been talking about people that are willing to either donate or signing a refusal to donate, but in this particular case, we're binding hospitals. And it says a hospital in the state shall enter into agreement or affiliation with procurement organizations for coordination of procurement and use of anatomical gifts. Do we currently have this in our procedure that the hospitals have to do this, or is this new?
I would like to have Bruce Sanoraitis, who from the organ donor organization, answer that. I don't deal with this on a day-to-day basis. I could give you my opinion, but he can tell you what happens in a day-to-day.
Okay, and
This is Bruce Sanoraitis, for the record, CEO of Life Alaska Donor Services in Anchorage. And that is correct. We have signed agreements with all hospitals in Alaska to allow for the process of donation and recovery of organs and tissues for transplantation research and education.
Okay, I missed the very first part of that. Did you say that you currently? I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah, we do have, and we have had for about 15 years.
Okay, thank you. So this isn't new then. Thanks.
Correct.
Okay. Do I see any other? No other questions noted. We do have Bruce. I'm going to say your first name because your last name is a little a mouthful for me. But was there anything else that you wanted to make comments on?
Yes, if I could make a brief statement to the chair.
Go ahead.
Bruce Elner is again for the record, Life Alaska Donor Services. There are close to 100,000 people waiting for an organ transplant in the United States, and about 180 people in Alaska, and 18 people in the United States die each day waiting for an organ transplant. So it's important to simplify and clarify the process of becoming an organ and tissue donor. HB 420 will update the Alaska's Uniform Act, as it was described earlier, to the 2006 version, which was passed by the National Commission from the 1987 version. It will remove obstacles to organ and tissue donation by clarifying language on who can grant consent to donation. It recognizes the benefits of donor registries, and in Alaska, we have a first-person consent registry that is now up to almost 335,000 Alaskans and continues to grow at a rate of about 800 per week, mostly through the DMV signups. The revised UAJ version also prioritizes donation for transplantation over research. HB 420 also further improves the relationship between the donation organizations and the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner plays a key role in the donation process, and most organ and tissue donations involve sudden, unexpected deaths, which fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Bruce. I don't see any questions. Let's go to Sherry.
Hello?
Sherry Badillo?
Yes.
Go ahead, Sherry.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Sherry Badillo, and I am a donor mom. My daughter, Sharday, she was 17. She was a senior at Colony High. She was their football manager for 4 years, and she was a nationally published poet. When I lost her in a car accident the day before Thanksgiving 2003, Sharday was passionate. She was full of life, and she loved others. And that supported my decision for donation. She was a skin, tissue, and bone donor. Her accident was sudden. It was, her death was instant, thank goodness. She was on her way to work. We lived in the valley. She was heading to work at the video store the day before Thanksgiving when she lost control. And bless her heart, she hit the only big tree on Trunk Road. I volunteer with Life Alaska, and what I've learned is when it's instant, donating organs is not possible. But through her skin, tissue, and bone donation, she helped 48 people across this country. And through that, Sharday continues to live on. Her donated skin has helped and been used in burn and reconstructive surgeries. And her bones and ligaments have helped other people walk and help their backs. Her donations have helped a six-year-old boy up to a 65-year-old woman. She lived life to the fullest, and it's helped me to continue and to live on, and knowing that Sharday lives on and her legacy is what has helped me. Listening to the conversation here, I didn't know that I had made the right decision with donation for Sharday. I had no idea because we had never discussed it. A couple weeks later, when I went through her room, I had found in her windowsill there was a little cup, and in the very center, going through it, I found a signed donor card. What I continue to tell people is to make their wishes known, to let people know that they want to become a donor. It's the most important thing that they can do. Recently, I became a donor daughter as well. My father passed away last month. He was so proud of what Sharday had done with her gifts to others and her legacy that he became a donor as well. And he's out there helping others. I can't say enough about donations, so I just wanted to share that with you.
Thank you so much, Sherry, for sharing with us. That's so meaningful. Representative Roses, do you have a question?
No, I didn't. I just wanted to make the same comment that you did. We certainly appreciate your testimony. It's very moving. And if you are volunteering, I'm sure you've had a positive impact on many, many people that have made decisions to donate. So we certainly are sorry for your loss, but we certainly applaud the decisions that your daughter and you and your father have made. So.
I just can't say enough about Life Alaska and the work that they do and the mission that they strive for. And they have helped me, like I said, continue to heal and to go forward. And anything that we can do to continue this, I really appreciate it, and so does my family.
And I didn't realize that you would at least know, you know, how many different people that were helped and things like that. And that's just...
It's exciting to hear. Unfortunately, with the HIPAA Act that was passed a few years ago, you know, we can no longer contact anyone. It's up to the recipients to contact the family. You know, and I haven't had that happen. I'm hopeful. They also were able to use Sharday's heart valves. You know, again, and what I have learned through my volunteer work with Life Alaska is, again, like I said, you know, they weren't able to use Sharday's organs. The only time they can use the organs is during a brain death, and that is not very often does that happen, because even with my father, he had a massive stroke, and he opted not to be kept on life support, so they were not able to use his organs, but he was a tissue and bone donor as well. But, you know, heart valves, you know, will save a child or an infant, so again, you know, she did save a life, and that was one of her goals.
How wonderful and how meaningful that all is. We really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you so much, and it's my honor, so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Kim McGee?
I'm sorry?
Kim McGee, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Kim, go
ahead. I'm Kim McGee, and I'm a recipient. I'm a two-organ recipient. I received a simultaneous pancreas and kidney transplant almost exactly 20 months ago. So I share my gratefulness about this law in perhaps a different way. First, I'd like to say that as a recipient, and I know this is true of all recipients, we are keenly aware and grateful for decisions that are made by donors and by donor families. And then the other thing is, I want to tell you a little bit about how I came to transplant, and that is I was diabetic, and it's very fun to say was diabetic, for 38 years, and with a good half of that in descending health from renal disease. Diabetes, as probably you know, is a very complicated disease, and kidney disease is a common accompanying problem. I became very ill and eventually was evaluated for and placed on the list for kidney and pancreas transplant. Fortunately, I was called. It was really a very exciting call, and I was able to be transplanted, which completely changed my life. I went from being very ill. You know, there are times when you go to sleep at night and you just really don't know that you're going to wake up because you just feel so bad. To when I came out of the operating room, I could ask for and get the lab reports, the numbers that I hadn't seen for decades. And immediately knew. You know, I hear other recipients tell me this, and I couldn't believe it before I knew it for myself. I knew immediately how much better I was. Having a functioning pancreas and a functioning kidney radically changes your life. You go from everyday descending to everyday you get stronger. It is something I could go on for a lot longer than 3 minutes. And I would encourage you all and everyone else to, in case of untimely death, my entire family has been and always is, was before my transplant, organ donors, signed to be organ donors. We have believed it was the thing to do, and now I'm incredibly grateful to be still living to tell you that it is a really important act.
Kim, how long has it been since you had your transplant?
20 months.
So I was diabetic for about 38 years, and no longer am.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Well, it's very incredible. I still feel myself diabetic, quite frankly. You just get too used to it.
Well, that probably means you're still taking good care of yourself.
I take very good care of myself. I am conscious constantly of I have two extra organs to be very aware of. I protect myself. I protect my stomach a lot.
Thank you so much, Kim. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else online that would like to testify at all? Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Okay. Then I will close testimony and ask the committee. This is, I don't know about you, but it's very moving to me to hear not only a recipient, but someone that gave an okay for to be a donor, and that is so meaningful. And it's just a joy to hear both of them talk, and it's just pretty neat. So, Representative Gardner?
Madam Chair, I just have a quick question, maybe for Dr. Butler or for anybody who can answer. Do we have any transplant facilities here in Alaska?
Dr. Butler.
Jay Butler again, through the chair, Representative Gardner. No, we do not.
Thank you.
Keep in mind, though, the discussion is really going beyond just organ transplantation, though, and tissue implants and things that are not so, if you will, high-tech are also involved in this bill, and some of that would be done in state.
Understood. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Ready?
Ready. Representative Gardner?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 420 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations, and I don't believe it's been amended by us, but from committee.
Okay, so we have a zero fiscal note, and hearing no objection, so moved. So we have passed the bill out of committee. So that's pretty exciting.
One down.
Next is House Bill 234 and Education Loan Repayment Program. And we've heard House Bill 234 in committee before, and the committee has had several questions, and the sponsor noted those questions. And we have a committee substitute before us, and would someone move version K for discussion? Representative Roses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move CS for House Bill number 234, version K, as a working document.
All right. And I will have Jeannie go ahead and explain the changes that you made because of the questions that was asked in committee.
Thank you. My name is Jeannie Osnes. I work for Representative Craig Johnson, and he is in House Finance at this moment, or he would be here as well. A number of the questions that came up could not be answered in this bill. Some were, and they were mainly questions brought in by Diane Behrens of the program that would be administering this. She's here today also to testify that this bill is good for her. The committee brought up questions that dealt with regionality of the bill and how this would work for hiring somebody or having somebody in an area that was considered in this shortage, severe shortage scheme. The regionality kind of stopped with the Department of Labor in that they felt that they couldn't actually do this regional part of the bill, and so that at this point has not been answered for what the committee did ask. After we heard the bill, our office received a number of calls because of the advertisement of it in the paper or people talking about it from it being on line. There were a number of people who called and indicated that they liked the idea of the regionality of the of what the committee asked. Health and Social Services came in, and they were worried about having it instead of being a shortage. They felt that turnover rate or vacancy rate per duty station would be something they'd be interested in. That also is a job classification in a region that may or may not be something that we can do with this bill at this time. We had been waiting for the Department of Administration's a work group report dealing with recruitment and retention. They have come out with theirs. Some of the decisions that they made in their group was that removal of specific degree requirements or replacing a specific general degree with a field-specific credit or specific degree requirements maybe being replaced with technical certification. And this is the Administrative Order 237 report that Commissioner Kreitzer put out. So in dealing with the bill and how the Representative Johnson wanted to have a student who has graduated from college, had a student loan, and came to Alaska to work, whether they worked for the state or they worked for themselves privately, it would be a job that would be identified under the statute that indicated severe shortage meant that a current or recurring job vacancy rate of 15% or greater, as determined by Department of Labor and Workforce Development, doesn't seem to be something that we can do at this point. Our Department of Labor is interested in working with the bill sponsor to try and come up with a better way to identify how these jobs would be listed, how they could possibly be regional, and probably get to the point where a list could be made available. But at this point, the statute that we have used in the bill isn't something that can be done by Department of Labor. We have an occupational forecast that goes to 2014. We have job opportunities that are available throughout the state. There are anecdotal reports or statements saying that we need teachers, we need social workers, we need auditors, we need, but there is no empirical knowledge that can bring that forward. And we have someone here from the Department of Labor who is a statistician or deals with research and analysis. And I think she can explain it a lot better than I can about a vacancy report that is not available at this point in our state. And that's, at this point, what this bill would look toward. And with that kind of a list, that's where you would be able to then possibly get into regional and get into the specific job needs where you would have so many on a list that would be available for this kind of repayment of loan.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Roses.
Thank you. So if I'm understanding, the way this is worded with the severe shortage and the fact we aren't able to determine what that severe shortage is, we can't do it regionally, are we creating a situation by which it's almost impossible for them to be able to determine who qualifies?
Correct. The statute has never been used, one, and two, the statistics that I don't quite understand, but the research and analysis that has to be done by the Department of Labor to make a list or to have a list that, as we were discussing, that you would have so many that would be eligible, and then as those became not the hot jobs, which is not the correct word, but not the job in need in severe shortage, another one would move in, and we felt that there could be this revolving list that would identify the needs that Alaska was needing at the time.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Rhodes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do know that the only area that I'm aware of where areas of critical need have been identified is in education. And when a piece of legislation that was passed that allowed retired teachers to come back and be rehired, that was based on an area of critical need, and that area of critical need was defined by whatever the school board said they needed for that particular school district. And so even though it changed from district to district as to what was critical and what wasn't critical need, at least there was a procedure in place where it could be identified from year to year as to what those were. But That's the reason that I asked the question to begin with, is because I wasn't aware of any such existence in the labor and workforce development area. So I guess it gives me a little bit of pause, because it sounds like what we're doing, without being able to clearly identify who they are, then it opens it up to everybody.
And I think the Department of Labor can answer that a little better, but we had thought, and looking on Department of Labor's website, there are Alaska's largest private employers, and then of course the Department of Administration has their personnel, and I believe that there are two different systems on how the state of Alaska identifies need, and then the largest employers that we have in the state don't seem to have a report that indicates that specifically Providence needs or Fred Meyer's needs, or that is out there that can be used as specific data so that it could be fairly used in a program like we're talking about.
You know what, Bryn Keith, can you come forward? Bryn is research chief with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I know when I've been on the finance subcommittee and of labor and workforce development, and I can remember that we got these charts that said which of the many different types of positions, and most of them were health oriented, but which ones were we low in, and can you kind of tell us about that and why we can't use those, or, you know?
I'd be happy to. And my assumption is the lists that you've seen in the past are those occupations that we predict are going to be in the most demand based on new jobs being created. So that's the demand, the employment side of the equation, not the supply, who's available to take those jobs. And in order to get at severe shortage occupations, one would need to calculate both. And we do have very good statistics on demand, again, the employment by occupation, both currently and in the future. But where we struggle, and to be quite honest, everyone in our business around the country struggles, is that supply piece. So that's really, for us, our Achilles heel.
Okay, now tell me this. I mean, the only thing that we could, a good way to go by it would be how many we're producing across the state. Is there any way to get that information?
We have some of that information, but that's just a piece of the puzzle, because, for example, you could have an individual who's skilled and trained in an occupation, let's say a nurse who's currently working in another occupation. They would potentially be part of the supply, but we might not be able to actually quantify that piece of it. And similarly, in Alaska, we have a very high rate of in and out migration. You know, every year, roughly 80,000 people come and go in our state. And a lot of those people are in the labor market. So again, that's the whole mix of who's here and what skills they have changing virtually daily. So it's very dynamic.
But isn't I'm thinking that the seasonal people move in and out, but there's
seasonal people in the military, and it's just, are very dynamic. We are the most dynamic state in the union, and a lot of that certainly is the seasonal nature of our economy, but there are other factors as well.
Representative Sisson?
Thank you. Working on this whole issue, I think I'm not quite understanding something. So I'm thinking about the fact that I've been to at least 50 different clinics, and oftentimes on the wall there'll be the list of the positions in the area that are vacant, and in many cases they'll say, yeah, these positions have been for, we haven't had them, we haven't gotten these, but we're funded for them, we just don't have them. And of course I ask for a copy and nobody will ever give me one, but at the same time, I guess my question is, okay, the demand, we know, and that's a demand side. If we can say there are X number of jobs and here's the range of of pay in these jobs, and in some cases it might be pretty reasonable pay, and we've actually got this other benefit that's available. Wouldn't there be a way to actually create a supply if the state actually started working on that?
We could get close to it, and we do that, though again, it would not be a definitive figure. In terms of determining a shortage, there's no definitive measure. Ideally, there would be an unemployment rate by occupation, and nationally, that can be done. Another option, potentially, is a vacancy survey, which is something, of course, that we're familiar with based on legislation, though Alaska's never done one. Now, a vacancy survey, an important thing to be aware of there is because there's a vacancy doesn't necessarily mean there's a shortage. A vacancy and significant number of vacancies could be a result of poor working conditions, not adequate wages. That doesn't necessarily indicate a shortage in supply. So it's a very complex issue and one that's very difficult for people in our field to measure. But you're right. We know anecdotally that there are lots of vacancies out there, specific industries and occupations. And really, when people in my business try to assess shortages, what we're really doing is trying to corroborate anecdotal information, because again, we don't have really solid information. Now, there are things we can do. We can look at those high-demand occupations that we project based on our occupational forecast. And certainly, demand doesn't necessarily equal shortage, but if there's a high demand, chances are there's not necessarily going to be an adequate pool to fill that demand. And then there are impediments to the market clearing, as we would call it in my business. Generally, if there's a shortage, wages go up, more people are attracted to the occupation, and the market clears. But there are impediments to that, one of which is education and training. It's expensive, and it takes time. So one could look at those demand occupation lists that you've seen in the past and really slice and dice it by the type of education and training that are required. That would be one option.
I think Alaska's going to find more and more vacancies because I can remember when we came here in 93. And the lower 48 pay scale was here, Alaska was here, and what's happened in the meantime, this has happened. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's no way right now unless we, this is a, it takes money to do this, but unless we raise the wages significantly, we are going to find ourselves in a crisis in Alaska because nobody's going to want to come up here unless there's a good reason. And I think that we're going to find ourselves in, it won't be too long either, and we will be in a crisis in many, many areas because of that.
And one caveat there is if the lower 48 goes into significant recession, we may then have a supply of workers that we wouldn't have had otherwise. So again, it's a very complex and very large issue. Our pool of employees, potential employees, come from the entire country and in some cases, globally.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think of that. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I was just actually going to endorse your point because I think we have a lot of examples when we look around us of job positions that are open, and it's not that people aren't available to do those jobs. I'm thinking of the police academy, for example. We have lots of healthy, bright, competent young men, but they're not going into the police academy because they just don't see it as a good option for themselves. So you could say Anchorage has a shortage of police officers. We always have police academies that just kind of don't get filled. But they're saying that they could make more money doing something else or working as a police officer somewhere else.
Representative Sisley, you have another question?
In the discussion piece here. I think personally that we need to start really working on this. And obviously, we're in kind of a flux between places in a way. I mean, that's what it feels like to me. We did have more money at one time, and we're able to pay people, and we have less now, and there's big things happening, and conditions are going to change. I think we need to start putting in place some things that change things. And I think this legislation is good, but I do think it needs to have some certainty that we're going to spend the money in a way that really helps the problem. And that's what the sponsor wants to do, quite obviously. And I'm just wondering if there aren't some kinds of solutions, like maybe, in fact, putting in a piece here that has a piece of funding out of the money that's been named here for a vacancy survey, and trying to, in that vacancy survey, put in some things that would tweak out whether or not this is a long-standing survey, a long-standing vacancy, and other things that might actually show what the conditions of that position are, so that we can compare spots around the state and be as close as we can when we actually give the benefit. Is that a possibility?
Through the chair, certainly a vacancy survey might be one source of information. One of the things we would struggle with in Alaska is how expensive it would be because of our economy. Because we're so seasonal, we would need to do probably a quarterly survey and probably 3 years worth of data collection before we would have good data. And I'm not even certain after the 3 years that the data would be adequate. I'm basing that in part on a survey done by Minnesota and other states. And of course, their economy is less complex in that regard than ours in terms of seasonality. And even though they've tried to collect data for, say, 500 occupations, four different geographic areas, I believe, they're only able to publish, meaning release it, for 21 broad occupational groupings. So they've not been able to have a response rate that will allow them to really provide solid data. So I would be concerned that even if we undertook something along those lines, that we may not actually be able to publish.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my then additional question to this is, if in fact you had it in the and it might be specific health occupations, and that might be something that somewhere along the line we figure out if we have a health commission, they might be able to name some of the things that they see as being significant holes. Might be in nursing, but there's other areas in the health field that are chronic vacancies. And that's important to tweak out where those big ones are. I think we might be getting there sometime soon. And you have that, and in education. So you kind of look at certain regions. You might be able to sort of make it not in perhaps the urban centers, but in places where it's maybe anecdotally areas that are high need. And if there was a way to construct something like that, would that make a cost difference?
Collection of anecdotal information would certainly be less expensive. It's much easier to do, though one, I think, would have to be cautious about making policy decisions based on anecdotal information. Mm-hmm. You know, the value of the type of data we generally produce in our office, because it's statistically very solid. So one can use it to make informed decisions.
And I have a question, but I think it's for Representative Moses. I know that the teacher placement group has, they pretty much know across the state exactly how many teachers we don't have and where the vacancies are and things like that, but we just don't have that in other areas of the state, I guess. And Representative Roses probably knows that better than anyone else.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you may be giving me credit for a lot more than I know, but I will tell you what I do know. It's much easier in that area to have a more stable predictability, because we know through a trend over the period of years what our projected decline in enrollment is, or what our increase in enrollment is going to be. So it's much easier to have a much more stable predictability, and so it's easier to say we anticipate having X number of positions vacant. But when you go into the private sector and you start dealing with I'll just use construction as an example, I can tell you one thing right now that has a tremendous impact on construction is what we do with our capital budgets. If we don't appropriate money in capital budgets, that next year construction is way down, and you have a whole lot less vacancies. If we pass a lot of capital budget projects and people are out there trying to get them funded, they're out there looking for everybody they can find to go to work. So there are too many factors that are involved in the private entity that we have no control over to be able to have any kind of a sustainable predictability in the process. So it's much easier with education. So it's kind of a kind of an anomaly compared to all of the other professions that are out there. So.
Representative Sisson, you have another question?
Just a point to follow up on Representative Rose's comment. Unfortunately, that also applies to health. And what you can look at is the budget that we do. And if, in fact, we're pouring our money into Medicaid, which is probably used more in regional centers where you're dealing with the chronic and end-of-life big money takers, and so that might even we might even build something that helps incentivize the legislature into taking care of the positions out there by having some stability of funding that we know is going to be in place.
Would help. I do have a question, but for Diane, for Diane Behrens, if we're through with questions for our current participant.
Okay, Diane, if you could come forward. Thank you very much, Diane. Representative Roses.
Thank you, Diane. I'm just going to kind of cut to the chase here. I think what I heard in the testimony is that this bill, as we have it before us, would be, I won't say impossible, but certainly in the best case scenario, it'd be very difficult for you to be able to administer. So if the language of this bill stayed the way it was, how would you go about trying to implement a program that's described here?
For the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission on Postsecondary Education. Through the Chair, Representative Roses, I think what we would end up with, to, at least to begin, would be something of a patchwork of the type of career areas that you've referenced in your discussion so far. There are reliable sources which the Commission could look to identify a severe shortage area. Those are in education. They are in healthcare. There may be certain other professional associations that track vacancy rates that we could rely on. There's information that Department of Labor could contribute. I think the only concern I would have as a program administrator is that there would be the question of fairness, that if you were looking at all of the careers in the state that required an associate degree or a bachelor's degree or some other of beyond two years or more, that there would be occupations where there probably was a severe shortage, but there would not be a reliable resource that could necessarily attest to that. So that would be the only concern. You could certainly proceed. You could establish a program. It could probably address a lot of issues, but it would not be complete, if you will.
Yeah, follow up.
Representative Roses.
And I appreciate that. We have heard testimony in this committee already on another bill that's out there that is trying to establish a grant program for students in the state. And there are no qualifications on that other than income levels, and it's based on need. And that one isn't a loan repayment. This one, however, is a little bit different than that because it's not those that are currently in school, it's those that have completed their school and have been working for a year. So this is a repayment as opposed to that one is an upfront payment. So we have two different bills that are floating around out there, and I'm struggling with both of them. And this one in particular, the equitability issue is difficult for me. The predictability is very difficult for me to get my hands around. And I don't know what the Chair's intent is, but, boy, I certainly would hope that we would hold this bill until we could get some clarification, because I don't like voting on something that I feel extremely conflicted and confused over.
And I should have mentioned that earlier, and I'm sorry I didn't. I do intend to hold this bill, and I don't know for how long, because it doesn't seem like there's an answer to the.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson realizes that, and both Bryn and Diane and our office can continue to work over the interim to discuss the different ways that maybe this could happen. We've received a lot of heartfelt emails and letters indicating, you know, this would be a wonderful program for me. I can't make my house payments. I'm, you know, paying off my student loan, and my wages aren't covering, and there is a need. There's a tremendous need out there, but this bill isn't the answer at this point.
Yet. Thank you very much, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question, but first I'd just like to say I'm glad you said that, because I see this bill as kind of a surgical strike to try to target a particular areas, and yet it's creating an incentive for behavior that's already happened. And if we really want to fill needs that we anticipate in this state, I'm not convinced that the way to do it is to go reward people who are already working in those fields, but rather at the outset getting 18-year-olds kind of turned, who could have the whole world of choices ahead of them, and we want some incentive that gets them to seriously consider the fields that we know we're going to need, however we measure that. But my question for you, Jeannie, is this. On the bill itself, on page 3, it's section D, starting on page 1, it says, in awarding educational loan repayment benefits, the commission will give priority to an eligible individual who was awarded a benefit the prior year. And I'm just sort of curious about that, because it seems like if there's not enough money to go around and this person's had it for 1 year, I'm not sure that I'd say that they should have a priority for getting it a second year and somebody else maybe could get it one time instead. Is that, am I missing something?
Chair, Representative Gardner. And I think this goes to Diane's concern, that once you start a program, and we indicate that there was $7,500 per year for 5 years, and somebody gets in that program, that they have the ability to know that up to 50% of their total loan would be repaid, because that's what the bill is indicating, that they can get 50% of their school loan repaid. And this way, if they're in the program, they can get to the end of their 50%.
Okay. And then just to clarify my understanding, these would be people who are already out of school, have already been working for a year, who took out those loans without any expectation that there would be a $7,500 a year loan repayment.
Exactly.
Thank you.
However, there was an expectation once they were picked that if they stayed in that area, it would continue. Mm-hmm. So that,
right.
You know, so there is an expectation once they're mm-hmm. in the program. Representative Roses.
Thank you. And this isn't a question. This is just a comment of something that I'd like you to look at as you're trying to put another bill together, because I think the idea behind the bill I support completely. I just want to make sure it's something that we can wrap our hands around and make work. And that's the fact that we have set this up so that it's a loan repayment for someone that gets a degree. But my concern would be, what if we had someone that already had a degree, but they're in an area where there's plenty of people, but they want to cross-train and then go back and get some additional courses to pick up a certification or something in a different area? It would exclude those folks from participating, because they're not getting a degree in that second area. They're just getting a specialty that would be in addition to what they already had. For example, if a person were already certified as a teacher, I'll use that one because that's the one I know the best. If they were already certified as a classroom teacher, but yet there's a tremendous need for special education, they went back and picked up a special education credential. They don't have to get a degree to have that. They already have it. But they would now have be certified in an area of particular need that we have had a hard time filling. I would hate to see them be excluded from this because they went back and picked up a second certification. And so if that isn't included in here, I would hope we would consider it.
Diane?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, I see this as enabling the commission to, by regulation, develop a program that makes sense. It would not make sense to me that someone whose career required the degree
went back, borrowed more money to enhance their ability to serve in that career, that that loan would not be subject to this. So I think it would be included. We would try to be reasonable in keeping with the spirit of the intent of the statute in further developing the program.
If I may follow up.
Follow up.
If that weren't specific language in here, if it weren't somewhere spelled out in regulations, then what we're operating off of the fact is that you're going to continue to be around to make that decision. And both you and I may not be here when that decision comes. So, and I appreciate that, and I was glad to hear you say that. But I would like to see it in writing so that when you and I leave, there is somebody else out there that has a clear definition of what our expectation is.
And through the chair, it would also have to be that is the need, the right job that's needed. And it seems to be in this state that that is one. So.
Okay. Thank you. And because I announced on the floor that this committee would be over at 4, I have to stick to my guns, and so...
Actually, ma'am is correct. You said it'd be an hour. You just didn't tell us which hour.
So, anyway, we are adjourned.
Okay.
So what did you guys do? Did you do something else?